Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining me. Boy, if you didn't have a hard enough time getting ready to go to sleep after our last guests and all of their stories, this next segment I think is going to really get to you. Our guest, Adam Bolger, will join us. Sudden and unexplained, the sleep deaths that inspired Freddy Krueger gave inspiration to Wes Craven for one of the most iconic and terrifying horror movie series out there. We're going to discuss that in the next segment. Speaking of horror movies, M. Night Shyamalan is back after a string of, I think it's fair to say, a lot of failures, a lot of failed, miserable movies that came out. You know, I'm a fan of The Sixth Sense. You kind of have to be. It was an amazing movie, original, well thought out, well done, well acted. Signs, another really good, really well done movie. The rest of his catalog, not so impressive. Well, he funded and financed and brought out a brand new movie that just came out this weekend called The Visit. And I had a chance to go see the movie. Here's my thoughts on it. I love a good scary movie. I love a good story. I got to be honest with you. I went in with absolutely low expectations because I just feel like he has not delivered a solid movie to us in, what, 15 years. Went into this movie, and it's an intriguing little plot line. The fact is that a mother has been estranged from her parents after, at the age of 19, falling in love with a substitute teacher and running off to be with him. She has two children, and now the parents have found her through the advent of social media and have asked to meet their grandchildren. So the mother decides to let the kids get a chance to meet their grandparents and sends them off for a week to go stay with Nana and Pop-Pop. And then all of these strange things start to happen once Nana and Pop-Pop pick them up. They're very nice, very congenial people who are also counselors at a local hospital and help out with mentally unbalanced people. And the story progresses, and you start to realize maybe Nana and Pop-Pop have some of their own unbalanced problems. There's some really interesting twists and turns to the story. I thought it was pretty well acted. They really lean heavily on a lot of the shaky cam. It's a lot of found footage kind of sense to it, as the young girl is a documentarian and she wants to kind of document this visit back to her mom's place where she grew up and lived and had all these tales, and see if maybe she can even mend some fences between mom and grandpa and grandma. And then they just start having very strange encounters that just keep adding up and amping up as it gets closer to the time they have to return, and lead you to a very strange crescendo. I got to tell you, this movie is not a horror movie. Straight out, this isn't a hacker slasher horror movie. It's not really even kind of a ghosty, spooky kind of movie. It gets into your head and under your skin as a good kind of psychological thriller that's really mixed with a lot of good laughs and funny moments. So I think it was really a well-balanced movie. And I'm surprised. Out of 1 out of 5 stars, I'll give M. Night Shyamalan's new movie, The Visit, a solid 3.75 stars. So if you're looking for something fun to do over the next couple of nights, next weekend, you're looking for a new movie to go out and try, I'd say The Visit. It's well worth it, and it's got a cool twist, good storyline, well acted, and it's good to see M. Night Shyamalan coming up with original ideas again. This was a really great original story that I think hit all of the bases and really kind of made its way. So check it out. The Visit, again, I give it 3.75 stars out of 5. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Adam Bolger joins us. We'll talk about the sudden and unexplained sleep deaths that inspired Freddy Krueger and kind of got that whole genre out there. We'll do that next. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Now we're going to take a fascinating look at sudden and unexplained the sleep deaths that inspired Freddy Krueger. Our guest is Adam Bolger. Adam, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining me this evening.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, it's unfortunately we're on the heels of a very sad loss to the horror movie and thriller genre with the death of Wes Craven a few weeks ago. Yeah, and I wasn't even aware. Was he fighting? Was it a form of brain cancer? Is that what it was?
You know, I don't know the details about that. I found out he died, and it was about a short time after I'd reached out to him for an interview. And his representation were very hush-hush about it. I thought that he had just been working on a film. I didn't even know that he had been ill.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's start to talk about this. What about this story and about the way this came down was so interesting to you that you put in so much time into the research?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a fascinating story.
Right.
It's amazing, and it has all these different levels, and it kept unpacking itself the more I researched it. A friend of mine became the editor-in-chief of Van Winkle's, which is a new website that's all devoted to sleep and issues around sleep. And obviously, I'm a fan of the Nightmare on Elm Street film series, and they're so great, and there's sort of a primal fear, you know, that they address in those films. And Wes Craven has always, in a lot of interviews, talked about his inspiration for it. And he said that he found a series of articles in the Los Angeles Times. Then they're just short little clippings, not features. And they're all about a group of Asian immigrants who are mysteriously dying in their sleep. And then the details he usually gave involved them trying to stay up as long as they could, and that they thought that someone was chasing them in their sleep. That there's some sort of agent or person or creature that was preying on them, and that they believed that they could escape that monster by either staying up as long as they could and avoiding sleep altogether. And the one story he often cites, like this young man was trying to stay up because he thought he was going to die in his sleep. And his family was trying to convince him that he had to sleep. And then he did end up dying in his sleep. And his family, when they went through his things, they found a whole full pot of coffee in a hidden Mr. Coffee pot in his closet. And he had been staying up for days because he knew that somehow he was going to die in his sleep. And that story has fascinated me since I was a teenager when I first heard about it. And having, you know, with this new publication, I had the opportunity to really dig into it and, you know, get to the, you know, try to find it, try to find those stories. And I just wanted to do that.
All right. Well, start to talk to us about this. I mean, again, you hear some of the conjecture and ideas behind this. And, you know, some of it was, from my understanding, some of it was overblown stories, some of it very real in what took place.
Right.
Walk me through some of the history and
sure.
What we do know.
Well, what I found out very quickly was that the story that Wes Craven told, and the one I tried to give you kind of the bullet points of just now, it didn't really happen that way. For example, Wes Craven, he said that there are these small stories, like kind of, you know, these little like crime blotter stories, and that he was the only one that put them together. That he alone saw that they are connected, which is probably not the case. There were big feature stories that were in the Los Angeles Times in the early 80s, not front page material, but like you know, like the second fold of the paper, or the second section, they'd be there, and the stories were all about this group of refugees called the Hmong. It's spelled Hmong, but pronounced Hmong. And they're originally from China, and then they emigrated to Laos and to Vietnam in the 1800s, and then they ended up in America in the late 1970s after they were involved with fighting wars in Vietnam and Laos. They were fighting alongside the CIA and the Laotian royal government against the communists, and they ended up being on the losing side. And then after that, about 35,000 Hmong came to America, and a lot of them ended up in refugee camps, and a lot of them died off because they really had a tough time of it, were the ones that stayed in Laos and Vietnam. Then they came to America, and they're settled in Orange County, California, Minnesota, other places like that, and they're dispersed across the nation. And they were, unlike a lot of Asian immigrants, they really weren't in a position to adjust to American society. They came from a rural background, They were what people politely say is pre-literate. Like many of them, the vast majority of them couldn't read. In fact, they didn't have a written language until, I think, the 1950s. And even then, many of them couldn't read it anyway. So they came to America unable to read, with, you know, really not up to speed with modern technology or culture or societal norms. And, you know, then they had to assimilate pretty quickly, like any other immigrant group. And while they were here, out of that 35,000 group, about 20 of them died mysteriously in their sleep in the course of about 2 years. Between, I think 1977 was the first reported instance, which was in Orange County, and then it just went away in 1981 or so.
And that was it? There was just no more cases of this occurring?
No. The no more cases among the Hmong. What investigators found, because it became, like I said, it became a, it got a lot of media attention because it was so horrific and so mysterious. People dying in their sleep for unexplained reasons. You know, people would just go to sleep healthy and have some sort of, experience some sort of trauma overnight and they'd be dead. And it was happening within this small community. And so it became very apparent very quickly because there are so few Hmong in the United States. And medical examiners, you know, they communicated with each other. There was a case first in Southern California, and then they didn't know what was happening. And so, you know, they took a note of it. And then something similar happened in Minnesota. And they were able to kind of put two and two together. They realized that it was the same ethnic group. And, you know, initially, if you look at the first couple of newspaper reports, they had no idea about it, and it was terrifying because what if it spread? What if it was contagious somehow? You know, how do you stop it? You know, what if these people that have been relatively isolated, they come into America and they spread this, you know, sleeping sickness to the general population? What do you do? So it very quickly got the attention of the federal government, got the attention of, you know, city medical examiners, and they tried to coordinate as best they could. And so then once that attention was there, and once they were, you know, they're looking at this closely, they realized that it was not a new phenomenon. They realized that what they called SUNDS, S-U-N-D-S, which is an acronym for sudden and unexplained. I'm sorry.
Nocturnal death.
That's right, nocturnal death. Yes, that it wasn't a new phenomenon and it wasn't unique to the Hmong. That throughout Asia, people had experienced. This is a long time experience. This is a long time thing. In Japan, they called it pokuri, which is death that comes in a snap, which is, you know, just 1 minute you're sleeping away contentedly, the next minute you're gone, which is evidently how it happens. That's what witnesses described, that you would just sort of see somebody, you know, sleeping, and then they would be struggling against something, and then they'd be gone. They came very quick. And also, in addition to Japan, I think it was in the Philippines, they had a word for it, which the translation was to rise and moan in sleep. And that was, you know, the same thing.
In the Hmong community where this was taking place, did they have superstitious beliefs of what was occurring? Was it demonic? Was it angelic? What was going on?
Well, it wasn't angelic, I'll tell you that much. But there was, because the Hmong were a pre-literate society, they were heavily immersed in folklore. They had this, they believed in ancestor worship, and they believed in nature spirits and things of that nature. and there was a creature, an evil creature that they believed was responsible for the deaths. And I might be mispronouncing this. It's spelled D-A-B-T-S-O-G, and I understand that it's pronounced Dacho. And it's an evil nighttime spirit that they believed would visit people in the night and sit on their chests and then sort of just snuff the life out of people.
So it sounds like the old hag syndrome that we talk about in the United States and Europe. It would be kind of this impish creature that would sit on you, or witch-like creature that would draw out your breath or draw out your life force.
You're absolutely right. This is a creature that cuts across so many cultures, and it comes in a lot of varied forms. And what you'll find is... the big thing, the big similarity with all of them is the method of death. They, you know, have you seen the documentary, I think it was called The Nightmare, that came out this year about sleep paralysis?
No, I have not seen that yet.
It's very good, but they interview a bunch of people who have suffered from sleep paralysis, and they talk about the visions that, these are all Americans, I think. And they talk about the visions they've had, and they all correspond with this Asian folklore and this Western European folklore, which is that there's a creature that, you know, is lurking in the bedroom, and it's trying to sit on your chest and snuff your life out. And while that's happening, you can't move. You can't get up. You can't fight it. You can't negotiate with it. It's there, and it's terrifying, and you're lucky if you wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it cuts across all these different cultures, and with minor variations. And with the Hmong, theirs was like a furry little animal, with its chief terrifying characteristic was teeth that you could see in the dark, just nothing but teeth, and covered in fur, like one. Hmong victim who survived a paralysis attack. He described it as like an American stuffed animal, but with just like a million teeth. So if you can imagine like Elmo coming at you.
No, Elmo. I have. I've got 7 kids. Elmo's been terrifying me for 25 years.
So you know what I'm talking about. So imagine like Elmo with like Jaws' mouth, and you're
right.
Seeing that in a darkened room in the dead of night, and you can't move.
Right.
And he's on your chest. And that's a Dacho. So that was the creature that was coming for the Hmong. And the idea, there's a really fascinating book that came out in 2011 by a woman named Shelley Adler, called Sleep Paralysis. And she researched the Hmong. She talked to many of them about this, you know, about the Dacho and about the sleep deaths and everything. And her supposition, you know, was that, you know, we can say that it's not real. We can say that the Dacho doesn't exist. But so then, you know, the Hmong people, they were tribal. And so they were, you know, everybody knew everybody else. Like it would be a small village. And if you needed a shaman, if you needed a priest, he lived 3 doors down. You'd get to him at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be easy to find someone, a way to rectify the problem spiritually. You could do that quickly, you know, within your community. But then once they came to America, and they're scattered across America, you know, they're in California, they're in Minnesota, and they're in other places, then you know the neighborhood shaman that your family had relied on for so long, he would be unreachable. So you had so you have this feeling that you're disconnected from the traditional way of dealing with this. The traditional cures were gone and unattainable. So all of a sudden, because you can't have a traditional cure, you can't have this traditional spiritual way of fighting this creature. Then it becomes fatal.
Well, we've got to take a break. We'll continue talking about this sudden and unexplained sleep deaths that inspired Freddy Krueger. What is the real story behind these? What are the encounters? Next hour, we'll open up phone lines. If you've had your own strange encounters with these creatures, with sleep paralysis and something that far exceeds just physical issues and night problems, then we want to know your story. So we'll open up the phone lines during that time. Stay tuned. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Are you having a little bit of a trouble falling asleep tonight? The idea of all these creepy stories and the idea of things stalking you in your room, kneeling on your chest, drawing out your breath, paralyzing you in your beds? Well, then don't go to sleep. Just hop online and check out Coast to Coast AM, where you can become a Coast Insider. Find all the great stories there. You can stay up all night long reading the news stories that we post there. You can listen to the archives of the show going 5 years back. That's right, 5 years back. And how do you do that? Just become a Coast Insider. 1 year subscription breaks down to just 15 cents a day. You get all the information and you've got a companion to keep you busy through the entire night. You never have to fall asleep listening to Coast AM. And you can also find a companion there. You can find somebody to spend your life and time with, somebody to huddle up against when you're terrified with the stories you hear on Coast to Coast AM by joining ParanormalDate.com, another one of George Norrie's programs. Check out ParanormalDate.com, where they've got, I think they're quickly approaching 24,000 members. You can join up for free and then stay on if you'd like to be a full-time member. They've got deep discounts available if you want to do that. And they're considering, I guess Hollywood has actually been talking to George about maybe turning it into a reality show. So who knows where it could lead if you become a member of ParanormalDate.com. When we come back, we'll talk more about the realities and terrifying experiences of sleep paralysis, these sudden nocturnal deaths, and more. We're covering that here. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Adam Bolger is my guest this evening as we delve into unexplained deaths, sleep deaths. There was a string of stories in the 70s and 80s said to inspire the late Wes Craven to create his iconic Freddy Krueger character on the Nightmare on Elm Street series. We're talking with Adam. He's got an article out, and we've got a link up to the article. We'll put it on the Twitter link as well. Just follow us at Coast to Coast AM. .com. Again, that's follow it on Twitter. I guess it's just at Coast to Coast AM. If you want to find more information about all the social media sites where you can get more information like this, go check out Coast to Coast AM.com. Adam, I had an interesting email come in during the break, and one of the listeners said, have any of the people who died, were they ever resuscitated to come back and explain like a near-death experience or out-of-body experience that they had during this sleep death?
Well, yes and no. There are people who were immediately treated with CPR when they suffered the attack, and they were able to survive. And so while they didn't die, like your email listener is asking, they were able to talk about their experience with the Dacho. And when I gave some of the details in the last segment, where the guy talked about, he's an older Hmong man who was attacked by sleep paralysis, and what he described was an American stuffed animal-like creature that was coming at him in his room, and he couldn't move, and he knew that his family was right in the next room, but he felt unable to get their attention either by moving or by talking.
Now, do we know of medical issues that can cause this same thing, that can create paralysis? I know that part of it is when we sleep, the basal part of our brain kicks in and kind of pumps out this anesthetic to the body to keep us from running in place or punching our, right, our spouse, because it kind of it dumbs down your body at night, so you're not hurting yourself or others, right, around you. And sometimes if we wake up too quickly, that anesthetic has not stopped pumping, and you'll have this feeling of paralysis. You're already in a deep reserved breathing pattern. Your heartbeat and heart rate is very, very low. And all of a sudden you can't take a full breath. So you go into this panic mode. And a lot of people say, oh, it lasted, 2-3 minutes, and 20 seconds, right, can feel like 2 to 3 minutes when you're in panic mode.
Oh, absolutely. When you can't move and you're fearing for your life, that moment will stretch on and on and on forever. But
what are the medical maladies that happen with this? Do we understand why people are getting this sleep paralysis?
You know, in a way, yes. We understand the physical. I don't know, mechanism of it has been pretty well mapped out at this point. There's even a completely clinical name for it. Now they call it Burundi syndrome, which is named for. Am I getting that right? It might be no Bugatta syndrome. I'm sorry. It's named for the two Italian doctors who were brothers, and they were researching these sleep deaths, and they were able to locate the exact place, the exact mechanism in the heart where the death was occurring. They found, the valve of the aorta, and they found that this is how people died. This is, when they died in their sleep, it was because of this one thing. And right now, I believe there's ongoing medical research where they're trying to map the genetic component that leads to it. Like why do certain people get it? Why is it fatal for certain people? Why are certain people susceptible to it, and for other people, it's never going to be a problem. But the larger question is not physical. The larger question is, metaphysical. We know that it works through the heart. We know that there's a preponderance to it with certain kind of genetic lines. But there are survivors. There are people just have sleep paralysis, and mm-hmm. they wake up, and it's unpleasant, but it's not fatal.
And from my understanding, a sleep paralysis, when it's something that's more clinical and something that you might want to look at a neurologist or a sleep study program, is if you're a back sleeper, that seems to affect most people that are back sleepers. Very right. few true sleep paralysis victims are stomach sleepers or side sleepers. Yeah. It's usually nappers, people that sneak in a nap during the day, and back sleepers that suffer from this. There's also medications that can be taken to have this, be avoided. That's why I've always had a problem with the quote unquote supernatural or metaphysical aspect of this, because right. I thought if it's really something, evil or dark lurking there, why would medication stop it from doing that?
Right. Well, part of it, this is how I'd address that. I think that you need to have to counter it with a belief.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of a grand placebo effect that seems to be in play. Again, to reference back to the documentary, The Nightmare, they interview a bunch of people who have been suffering from sleep paralysis. And two of the people in the film, they talk about how they were cured. And one of them became a Christian, became a devout Christian. I think they said that Jesus appeared to them and told them, told her not to worry. And that, Jesus was taking care of them, of her. And from then on, she didn't suffer from this sleep paralysis. Another victim of sleep paralysis, he was visited by, I think, some kind of woodland spirit. It was, something more like a like witchcraft, but like white witchcraft. I'm sorry, I don't know that much about it, but it was like a New Age sort of spirit, and a New Age sort of wood spirit.
So like an elemental.
An elemental, yeah.
Exactly. Right, okay.
Wonderful term. He was able to put his faith in this elemental to protect him, and that made the attacks go away. And so it's like, if you have a belief in it, if you have something that you are confident will ward off the sleep death, that seems to be the most effective way of warding it off, just this belief. Because to get back to what I was saying about the physical versus the metaphysical, element of this, the Hmong victims, if it was genetic, and it certainly is, it certainly seems to be this genetic preponderance for this sleep death, that must have been in play for generations, but it only really suddenly happened when they came to America. And the connection seems to be, and I'm borrowing liberally again from Shelley Adler's work here, is that they're away from, they're divorced from their belief system. They're divorced from their traditional cures. And they believe that they are doing something wrong by not practicing their traditional ways. And that was something that was shaking them to the core. And so,
could it be even something maybe more dark and nefarious, like they came to the United States and started eating a lot more fast food and became heavy set and suffered from sleep apnea?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that fast food is totally insidious.
Because I just wonder if, you know, the evil started when they got to America. Does it really have to do with turning their back on their society? Or is it because their patterns changed with what they ate, how they ate, or, you know, how they did things here?
Well, that's an interesting idea, but it doesn't seem to be borne out by the actual victims. For example, the first case, that was found, the guy in 1977 in Southern California, he was said to be in very good physical condition. He was a paramedic, I believe, and so he knew a lot about health. He knew, and he was very conscious of his body. He was very conscious about exercise and diet. So at least in that case, that seems to argue against, you know, being introduced to American, you know, it seems like McDonald's might not have murdered him.
Yeah. I'll be the judge of that.
Right. But what I was going to say was that, so they know the physicality of it, but, you know, there's the idea is that this spiritual crisis kind of set that in play. Like the mind is saying, you know, we're away from our culture. We're away from these things now. We're doing something wrong, and you must suffer for it. And so here's how you're going to suffer.
Now, when you talked about the fact that some of these Hmong people that witnessed these creatures would say that they were short, fuzzy, kind of almost like stuffed animals with sharp teeth and creepy looking.
Yeah.
Do you see that different cultures, different beliefs have a different sighting of what it is that's coming at them? Or does this transcend the different belief systems, religions, and faiths? Is it always these furry critters that are trying to attack them?
There are a lot of similarities, but the looks do change. Like, for example, the Filipino in Tagalog, the native Filipino language Tagalog, has a word called the batabat, which is very similar to the dacho. And it's, you know, the way it works is the exact same thing. It's an evil creature that attacks sleepers. But they come from trees. They look like ugly, obese women, and they infest houses that were made out of the trees where they used to live. So the look is different, but the way that they kill is exactly the same. There's also there's a Japanese dream creature called the Baku, which is pretty amazing, and it's very the way it acts to the dacho is very similar, but the way it looks is incredible. It's a piecemeal creature. It has a bear's body, an elephant's trunk, and an ox's tail, and it feeds on dreams. And Japanese children will call to it if they wake up from a nightmare. And then you have a lot of variations on the night hag. And I'm sorry, I'm referring to an article that I've written about these creatures that hasn't been published yet. So I'm scrolling down now.
No problem. As long as you're giving us the names, it's intriguing to see the way that different cultures deal with these creatures.
Yeah. Well,
or this belief, I should say.
With some of them, you can defeat them by being clever. And those are my favorite. Like there's the jinn, which is, you know, like the genie.
Right.
Yeah, in Turkish culture. And so sometimes the jinn will act just like a dacho. And if you see a jinn attacking you in your sleep, and if the jinn is wearing a hat, you can steal the hat, and the jinn will be your slave.
Interesting. So just by altering it, it makes me wonder if this is something that, you know, they're empowering people with these beliefs, you know, because again, if people have the belief that this is happening and that they are being attacked, if you give them an out and tell them, you know, remove the hat and you'll have the power.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's very similar to Freddy Krueger, right? I mean, in the first movie, when Nancy goes in, she drags something back from that world,
yeah,
from the dream state. And then it kind of shows, you know, is there a connection between what we think and conceive and will it become real?
Right. Like in Russia, sometimes mothers will put a knife in their baby's cribs to try to ward off the Nakhnista, which is a nightmare creature. But you're absolutely right, because you know these are stories, and they're stories and they're beliefs, and they do correspond with physical things, physical happenings. But you know because they are stories, they have to have an ending, and they can either end in death or they can end in something happy.
All right. Well, I guess I can see that, but you've got these creatures that are appearing up, popping up. People from all age groups, religions, mm-hmm, races are having experiences with this sleep paralysis, with this case of what they call the old hag syndrome in America and over in Europe. So this is something that's been around for centuries. There's famous paintings kind of depicting and images and carvings that depict this phenomena as well. So it's a very real phenomena in the sense that many people have dealt with it, but is it more medical or is it more spiritual? And do we have any, you know, do any of the religious groups, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, do they have an explanation for these things or how to deal with them aside from calling on Christ? I mean, is this something that they take serious, or do they find that it's nothing and most likely just our psyche or our own minds at work on us?
You know, I really don't know. I really don't know if there's, I'm a Christian. I was raised Roman Catholic. I don't think I ever encountered that at CCD. I don't know. Maybe people have other experiences. Maybe when we go to the phones, maybe people be able to tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, and we'll do that. We'll open up phone lines after the top of the hour. If you've had your own experience or seen or witnessed something during these moments, we'd love to hear from you about that. You can share your stories with Adam and I as we progress through the show. Have you personally had an experience like this, especially after you start researching it and it's in your mind, you've awakened it or it's awakened you? Have you had anything happen?
When I was a child, I had moments of, you know, what you were describing earlier, when you wake up and your mind is active, but your body's not quite in gear, and you have that terrible, terrifying moment where you can't move. I remember that very distinctly. It's funny, when I was doing research for this, I was in the shower the other day, and I thought of something terrible on the other side of the door. But I'm not a superstitious person in general. I think that the fact that I don't believe in ghosts and things of that nature, I'm not susceptible to it. I'm not a risk.
Okay, but were you being facetious when you said that you saw something or thought you experienced something?
I was not being facetious. I was being... it was a moment of dread. Like, even though I am, in general, I'm not a fearful person. In general, I don't fear the supernatural. But it was a moment of complete dread of, you know, what if this was real? And what if I was just going to come to me in the shower? You know, what could I do? I'm as vulnerable as I can be. And that's another thing about the sleep death is, you know, you're in your most vulnerable state. You're asleep. And that's part of the sheer extreme terror of the phenomenon.
You know, let me throw this out as I'm sure we have so many people that are into the metaphysical aspect of this and know about astral projection. One of the things I've often wondered about when we discuss things like sleep paralysis, you have this consciousness, this awake feeling, and sometimes you'll notice things in the room with you. And I often wonder, since when we're attached to our body, we're always connected to it in an astral form when we leave, I often wonder if when we wake up and we're in this sense of paralysis and then all of a sudden it snaps back and we're into it and we've noticed something else in the room, could it be our own form, our own astral form returning to the body?
Right.
And that's why we sense it. We see what's going on and we can't move yet because the essence of who we are, the energy, the battery, if you will, has not gotten back into the body.
Huh. That's a really interesting idea. What do you think? My question for that supposition would be, do you think you'd naturally react to that with fear? Do you think you'd naturally be afraid of your astral projection?
Well, if you don't understand exactly what you're doing or understand that you're projecting, it might be frightening. We'll talk about it more. We'll open up phone lines in the next segment as we continue on. Adam Bulger and discussing these sudden sleep deaths. What makes them happen? These moments of sleep paralysis, creatures in your room, shadow people stirring about your bed. What are your experiences? Call us and let us know. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.